This audio was recorded at the 2010 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. The session was Fighting the Crisis, and it asked the question, after the anti-capitalist blocs and the Anglo-Irish protests, how can we build to defeat the government and make the rich pay for the crisis? You'll find more audio from the book fair at www.wsm.ie.
Collapsed. There are more stable institutions, so it was basically an emergency measure to stabilise the situation by moving all of this cash that people couldn't pay from being owned by private institutions to the public sector. Now, the problem being that moving that debt into the public sector doesn't make it able to be repaid. So we have now a situation. So as that process was happening with the various bailouts, we had a situation where there was a nominal recovery in the financial markets. The stock markets sort of rebounded a bit. GDP's, the slide in GDP and unemployment slightly slowed down. However, we've now, in the last couple of months, we've started to have all of these sovereign debt crises with Greece and the whole of the European Union under threat. And basically what we have, we still have this huge problem that there's all of this debt that's unrepayable, and it's now been transferred to the public sector. And the big problem with that is debts that remain with the state can survive and persist for generations. So we've sold, essentially, while this keeps on going, we've sold the future out of, you know, future generations in Ireland in particular. Now, to come to the Irish situation, people in Ireland tend to talk about it in a, you know, Ireland was a bit different, and it was a bit different, but it wasn't that different. You know, the same thing happens everywhere. What's different in Ireland is, essentially, we have a very opportunistic and Gombean-ish ruling class who, you know, really didn't care about any of this type of economic thinking. They're just thinking, well, we're hitching ourselves to this bandwagon, everybody's doing it, we'll make a few quid. So they put in place nothing, no protections that some of the other states did. And so Ireland just is, you know, it gets the worst of it because, as I say, the nature of the Irish economy is it's always been sort of quite opportunistic, built around, and particularly in the current era, it's built around, like, essentially tax rate arbitrage, allowing American multinationals into Ireland, into the European Union, within the walls of the European Union, and paying very low tax. And as I say, like, so Ireland, so whereas we often look at it in the context of Ireland, you know, these Fianna Fáil or Gombeans and stuff like that, it's just the same everywhere. We have the very same processes of all of this debt being moved to the public sector and still being unrepayable. And as I say, really when it comes down to it, it's a question of distribution of wealth. I can't see any, there's no way that because the people who owe these debts can't repay them because they're impoverished, essentially, there is no real solution to this crisis unless that's addressed. And a significant problem is that's just completely not on anybody's agenda, you know. And the ways to address that type of thing is to cancel debt, for example, or increase wages. These are ways that you could get out of a recession like this, because it means that people can start to repay the debt. But until and unless that they do, we're going to see, I think, over the next few years, an accumulation of sovereign, which is state-based debt crisis. And as I say, this is already happening in a major way. Greece, Ireland, and the so-called pig economies are very much near the brink, but the United States is not far off, and Britain is very close as well to being in a situation. And of all of the standard economists, what they say about this is, well, we just basically hope that our economies return to growth and we get extra tax rates. But it's very, very difficult to see how that can happen in a situation where people have these crushing debt burdens that they can't actually start consuming and having input into economic growth, because all that they can possibly attempt to do is service their debts. And whereas these debts are at such a stage that Ireland is a great example. Like, anybody who bought a house between like 2005 and 2008 will never be able to repay them, because they were they were given, you know, mortgages at 10 times income and stuff like that. And that's almost, you know, there's no possible way. Interest rates are being kept artificially low for a short period of time, but that can't go on forever. And any bump in interest rates, which you need to get back to any type of growth, will mean that all of those debts collapse again. So essentially, globally, and particularly in Ireland, it's sort of a grim picture. We have an entrenched division of wealth that is destroying the global economy, and with very little prospect in the short term of anybody doing anything about it. Okay, so.
Okay, well, that's a cheering note to start on.
Yeah. We can do.
I've got to make it better. Our starting point in terms of this discussion is that the working class in Ireland has suffered a massive defeat over the last 2 years. A defeat measured in terms of job losses, double-digit pay cuts, and huge cuts in service provision. Unlike some on the left, we don't share the perspective that recessions are good times for the growth of radical left ideas. The historical experience has tended to be a growth of authoritarian and right-wing nationalist politics, as workers are set against workers in competition for dwindling numbers of jobs and services. And obviously, in the worst-case scenario, you get the sort of thing we saw in the 1930s all across Europe and elsewhere in the world, with the rise of kind of fascist regimes. Despite this, we're revolutionaries, so giving up and going home is not a particular option. This is where we are, so we have to look at what can be done. As I said at the start, this session was added to the programme quite recently because of the coverage and energy generated by some of the quite minor street protests and stunts organised by political groups like the Socialist Workers' Party in Airgi, and then our own involvement in terms of the anti-capitalist bloc. If these had a use in combating demoralisation among a layer of activists, they don't, however, offer us any particular way out of this sequence of defeats. And I think that's an important sort of point to start at. With the markets again tumbling, the depth of the crisis remains uncertain. Chekhov certainly wasn't giving any good news there. But nevertheless, the attacks that the bosses need to launch on the working class to get capitalism on back on the road to recovery remain massive. If the crash continues, the possibility that the depth of the cuts themselves will force workers to take radical action as the most logical solution to the problems remain on the agenda, even though many workers at the moment are opting for individual methods of surviving the crisis, including emigration. I work in the public sector, so we've gone through two very substantial range of pay cuts, and obviously it makes up a lot of the lunchtime conversations. And you know, the way people are reacting, although more people have joined the union, tends to be of ways of, you know, moving their shopping from Tesco to Lidl and, you know, sort of not going out and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of the conversation revolves around how you can save money rather than how you can fight back. The importance of the protests of the last couple of weeks is that, despite their small size, they demonstrate there are some still willing to resist. But we need not give up on the working class completely in general in fighting back. And I think the key thing to look at is the public sector strike of last November, because whatever about the weaknesses it revealed in the organisational abilities of the unions, it also illustrated that despite some pretty deep fears, workers were willing to fight back. I mean, most of the people, I was helping coordinate half the pickets where I work, and most, I think everybody there except two people had never been on strike before. So this was a new experience basically for just about everybody who was actually working there, which is kind of extraordinary when you think about it, because that would have, you know, included people in their 40s, their 50s and their 60s. However, rather than escalating the dispute, the ICTU leadership called off the second one-day strike on the basis of promised talks, and once again those proved to be meaningless. And we've been in this cycle where the union leadership have repeatedly sabotaged what movement there is from the base. Now, I don't want to overemphasise that, because I think it's also true that, as I said, a lot of ordinary union members are very cautious, and it's not like there's a huge demand for a fight coming from the base either. But the union leadership as it exists has not only not pushed that, it's very much discouraged any talk of large-scale industrial action. The work to rule implemented as an alternative strategy in the new year saw a very mixed implementation and results. It was locally very effective in a number of high-profile cases, and obviously the passport office is the one everybody was aware of because it was on the Joe Duffy show every day for about 10 weeks. But it also played into the hands of the government and IBEC in terms of helping them set the agenda they want to set of this being a conflict between public sector workers and the rest of society. So a lot of the talk radio, you know, concentrated on people who couldn't get their passports to, you know, go on their holidays or whatever, and weren't these public sector workers terrible. And it's part of the problem with work to rules in terms of the public sector, because obviously what you're doing is you're taking away services from
the rest of society and the rest of the working class, and that's bound to cause a certain level of conflict. Despite this, however, the Works Rule was probably the reason why the government felt forced into taking talks with the unions more seriously, which resulted in the public sector agreement. And that agreement is really no different from what the unions were trying to get back in November and what the government, in terms of the budget, hadn't been interested in. Now, the public sector agreement itself offers next to nothing. Worse still, in fact, it undermines working conditions in return for vague promises to just have inflation rate pay cuts for the next 4 years. Despite this, the ballots on it, well, actually, at the moment, it's going mostly against. So it's about two-thirds, one-third in terms of actual numbers of votes cast. But both Impact and SIPTU have yet to report the results. They're the biggest unions, and because both executives have recommended yes, it means there's a chance that overall the thing will be carried. In fact, I think that's probably the probability. And in SIPTU in particular, no campaigners were denied access to union publications to argue the case for a no vote. So that kind of gives some of the difficulties we're facing as well. We can't even, in some of the unions, we can't even get access to having a debate with the membership. You know, you're having this leadership-led push for a kind of attempt to return to sort of social peace underneath the worst possible conditions, and not even much of an answer to not even much of an opportunity to answer that. Now, it's our opinion that that turning this around is not something that's going to be rapid. It's not something that's going to happen in the course of weeks or in the course of months. And what's needed is the construction of a genuine united front of struggle against the cuts on a non-electoralist basis that involves left organisations, union branches, community organisations and campaigning groups. And I'm listing all those out because you get a fair amount of discussion on the left about left unity, and what left unity typically means is that everybody should get together in an electoral alliance. I think that's completely, even apart from the fact that as an anarchist I don't think elections operate a way forward, I think it's also completely the wrong way to look at it, because it actually focuses on where the most immediate differences are going to be on the left, but it also sees the left organisations as kind of leading the struggle, rather than seeing it as being essential that we also build in terms of, you know, unions, communities and campaigning organisations. The left is tiny in Ireland. It doesn't actually have much influence. Trying to base something purely on the left alone, it isn't going to go anywhere. This needs to be based around a common set of slogans against and to reverse the cuts that have happened. And we need to proceed by getting individuals and organisations to sign up for a call for a founding conference of such a united front, which will be open to all who agree that the wealthy rather than the workers must pay for the crisis. And we kind of think it needs to be done on that kind of quite broad, loose basis. I mean, the tendency is very often for people to come up with, like, you know, 20 points that are going to sort out all the details of each of the crisis. But the problem with that sort of approach is that's exactly where you're going to get the disagreements about, well, we don't want to do that, we want to do this. And what's really needed is an alliance based on fighting what's coming and fighting to reverse it, rather than one that worries about the precise details of how that's best done. And I think the other important thing, because what we're seeing at the moment, and in fact what we've seen for most of the crisis, is the setting up of various things that would claim to be something like this. Sometimes with good intentions, sometimes the intentions are more mixed. So at the moment, for instance, we've got the SWP setting up the Right to Work campaign, and that's sort of running at the moment and trying to present itself as we are this broad alliance. We've seen things like the Public Sector Alliance, which was set up by actually one of the union branches around Paddy Healy, back about, what, 18 months ago, a year ago or something. We saw Grassroots Unite, which was set up by the SIPTU Education branch. And there's been various other initiatives. Actually, the Social Solidarity Network that we were involved in setting up would also fit into that general pattern. And I think, retrospectively, these are all the wrong approach, because the idea that it's possible for one or two political organisations or one or two union branches to set up a flag and that everybody else is therefore going to flock to that flag. Now, the level of both sectarianism within the left, but also the history of the left in Ireland and the kind of legitimate reasons why people tend to distrust other groups, other organisations, means that sort of initiative isn't going to go anywhere. So in terms of strategy, I think what we need to be looking at is how, over a period of 1 or 2 years, do we build towards the situation where you can actually create something that's real and that at its starting point involves not only a fair range of left organisations, but also, you know, a significant number of union branches. I mean, there's probably 10, 15 branches in the country where the left has a fairly large influence, with the more radical end of the community sector, and also, you know, campaigning organisations that are struggling around the crisis on various issues. I'm involved in Shelter Sea, for instance, so that's one example, but there'd be no shortage of other ones. So, lastly, we're going to have Aileen, who's going to talk a bit about what can be done in the union context.
Yeah, I was going to make three kind of simple points maybe that people can think about. And one is to think about where do we think people, where do you think the fight back is going to start, and who's going to try to start struggling and resisting against the cuts that are being imposed. And I think if you look at the Irish population, there's five different types of people. There's the people who are actually genuinely unaffected by what's happening. And there are a couple of those. Like, there are people who, say, bought their houses in the 70s and are retiring now and are actually not very affected by the cuts. There is a much larger group, and I'd say this is probably the mass of Irish society, who I would say are the sullen discontent. They're unhappy, but they're not going to do anything about it, bar moan at coffee breaks. And I think everybody's met them, certainly in my workplaces, is a lot of grumbling about what's going on, but doesn't actually grumble towards anything. It's just unhappiness. Then you've got the angry people. Then you've got the angry people who take a little bit farther. They actually want to resist, and you see them going on marches. And then you've got the militants, the people who are actually organised. So in terms of who we target our arguments about and who we're trying to organise, I think what we have to do is be aware that we're not really going to meet the mass. We're not going to get the sullen discontented. There are people who might follow if a resistance happens and it's seen that it might be effective, but until they see something that's going to convince them, they're going to sit being unhappy but not moving. So when we're thinking about who we're targeting, we have to be thinking about the angry people, the resistors and the militants. The second thing I want to talk about is my own experience as working in trade unions. The very first trade union, I've worked as a contract worker, which means I've moved workplaces every couple of years. So the first workplace I was actually in Trinity, and I joined SIPTU. And my experience of joining SIPTU was getting the application form from the internet, downloading it, filling it in, sending it off, and I never heard anything from them again. I do know I was a member because the money was taken out of my account, but I had absolutely no interaction with them at all. Then I moved workplace, I moved to UCD, and in UCD SIPTU was the main union there. So again, I joined SIPTU within the forum. This time I was sent a membership card in the post, so I did have something physical that proved that I was a member. And I think I was there for 3 years, and for the first 2 years, absolutely nothing, no communication. I did get a ballot for the partnership agreements in the post, but nothing about what, you know, partnership, no arguments, no sense. I didn't even know who else was in the union, no sense I was actually a member of an organisation. That changed a little bit in the last year when new management was introduced in UCD, and there was a lot of unhappiness and unrest. They were trying to change working conditions, particularly among contract workers, and there was one or two public meetings. So that was the first time really where I was a member of a union and I got to meet other members of the union. I felt I had a sense about something, but again, it was very, very, very minimal. And I think that reflects the grassroots experience of what partnership was. For the first year, it really didn't matter whether I was a union member or not, unless I actually got into, you know, I had specific personal problems within, you know, with a particular manager, in which case I could have gone to a union. So for me, those first years, union was essentially an insurance policy that I took out, you know, against having trouble with it within my workplace. And I think that's the way SIPTU saw it as well. That's how they saw their members. They were taking on insurance policies. And because everything was negotiated at a partnership level in talks that were publicised and seen on the news boardroom somewhere else, for the ordinary union member, they had no real involvement. Then I moved workplaces again, and this time I joined IFLIP because that was the union that most of the people working in my job were in, and that was different in that now I was on a mailing list, so I was getting notice of meetings that were happening. I was getting notices of things that, you know, the president of the union was mentioning. I went to an AGM, the first AGM of a union I've been to, and as often happens, because I'm left wing, I was elected to the branch committee, and it was, as often happens in unions, it's who wants to, you know, who's left in the room at the end of the meeting wants to go forward. It wasn't the sense that I was carrying, you know, positions of members forward. It was more like hands up, okay, anybody's got their hands up, you're now the branch committee. And then the political situation changed, partnership fell apart, and the union started to change. And it was quite interesting for me, being an activist being on a branch committee, because I was on the committee with people who've been on the branch committee for 10 years, and the sort of work they were doing was a sort of mundane, dull, but actually very important. Their main work was going into meetings with HR, or going into meetings with management, and arguing on behalf of individual members, or trying to block management when they were changing working conditions. But it was very hidden and invisible to most of the membership, and it was very much a matter of routine work. You made sure you went to every meeting with management so that they didn't try and slip something in underneath the carpet. And what I found surprising is, in terms of the people who were doing this work, and it was work, to be honest, I would not have wanted to do myself. I would have just died from the boredom and the tediousness of this kind of thing. But their attitude, they were very good people, but their attitude to the union was, this was a job that we did on behalf of the membership. And the membership wouldn't turn up to the AGM, which was quite poorly attended, and they would find that very frustrating and quite annoying. But they had no conception of how to get the membership more involved, or that perhaps they should be taking the membership's views forward. I guess it was more they saw themselves as representing people rather than having a direct democracy approach to it. So, for example, I was always pushing to have meetings for all the members when there was a big issue, like we had the strike or the vote. And as an activist, I found it strange that I actually had to argue for those things because they weren't obvious to people. Or I had to argue that the minutes of meetings should be circulated to all the members. And some of the branch committee argued quite strongly against that and tried to block it. And again, I thought that was really weird. If you want to have if you want the ordinary member to be interested in the union, then you have to tell them what the union is doing. If they miss a meeting, you have to tell them what they've missed so they go to the next one. But a lot of the existing branch committee had been doing a very good job. They had a particularly comfort zone. They wanted to keep doing that job. They wanted the support of the membership, but they didn't necessarily want to give over any of their power to the membership. So obviously there was a strike happened again. I found it quite interesting because I'm politically active and I have quite a lot of experience as an organiser. The sort of things you need to do when you have a strike: you have a rota, you have who's going to do there, you have pickets, you have press releases, you have leaflets. Nobody had a sense of what you needed to do at all, and there was no instruction from our president of our union, who's paid I think something like 150,000, 200,000 a year, and yet couldn't get placards, couldn't get pickets. Union branches were not instructed to picket. They were told it was up to themselves. And it was a huge vacuum in terms of how to organise what is a big, pretty big major event. And as it happened, it was quite successful and there were pickets placed. But as an organiser, it was one of those things where we fumbled into doing things right rather than actually being organised. And over the course of the year, people who have been, who would have been active in the union, who are left-wing and who have dropped out, I think, over the years of the partnership agreement, have become more active, have been more involved. And at the last AGM, we elected a new branch committee, which is much more left-wing than the previous branch committee meeting, and much more interested in doing things and trying to engage the union. But as an anarchist, one of the problems I find with them is that they have a lot of criticisms about how the union works, but all the criticisms are directed towards the leadership. The leadership is selling the workers out. We have to get a better leadership, and there is a lot of truth in that. The leadership of the unions has been very conservative, but there's also the unions are dynamic. There's the leadership and the members. And often the leadership, if you talk to the conservative leadership, they're saying, we're going as far as we can, our members don't want to go any further, our members aren't willing to fight. And often they're right. So one of the things I would argue that within 5 years ago when I joined my first union, there was no space for political activity really within the union. Now that has changed, that there is a space for people to act. 5 years ago, I would say that it would have been, pretty impossible to engage ordinary members in union activity. Now I think it is possible to engage ordinary members in union activity. And I think that's important because the unions are the largest collective organisations in the country. the largest public resistance to the cuts have come from the unions. The unions have a huge potential to resist, not in a symbolic way, but in an effective way. They actually, the public service workers have the potential to close the country down, but that is not a potential that's been realised. It's been hinted at, but it's been dissipated. So the question for us now is, what do we do with this situation? It looks like the Croke Park deals will be accepted. If they're accepted, say worst case scenario, all of the impact and all the SIPTU votes go to the Croke Park deals, which I don't think will happen. It would look like three quarters of the people voted will have voted in favour, and one quarter would have voted against. That one quarter is about 50,000 people. So that's who I think are your angry people, who will possibly become resistors and will possibly become militants. So what we need to do is to work out within our unions, how do we put more pressure on the leadership? And crucially, really, how do we engage those people who did vote against the Croke Park deed agreement, who are angry, and how do we mobilise them so they become not just angry, but also become resistance and also become militants and are in a position there to put pressure to possibly force the leadership to act, to actually fight against the cuts that are going on.
Okay, thanks, Aileen. Part of the reason actually we asked Aileen to do that was if you read, I think, the magazine, the New Free Magazine, Irish Anarchist Review, we talk about this a lot, but it's actually, in terms of our own internal experience, we've a number of members who quite quickly went from being either only very marginally involved in the union or not involved at all, or that experience of filling in a membership form and never even hearing back from anybody, to the position where they've actually become quite active, you know, going to union conferences and branch committees, etc., within the space of 7 or 8 months. So we think often it's a problem that people, kind of, if they haven't been doing that sort of thing, they look at it and they think, well, that's impossible, you need to be doing it 20 years before anybody will take you seriously. But there's definitely, at the moment, because of the level of activity and, you know, the fact that a lot of people recognise the need for militancy, there's opportunities there for basically anybody who's working somewhere, particularly if it's already unionised, to quite quickly move through things. And if we're talking about stuff over, you know, this is a 1 year or a 2 year process and not a 3 or 4 year process, I think that really makes sense for everybody to be considering in terms of, like, concretely, this is one of the things I can actually do. We talked about some of the other sectors as well. Yeah.
I've got a question first and a comment. Is it possible in Ireland to form independent unions? Do unions have to be registered to be proper entities, and is it possible to form new ones?
Yeah, unions have to have a union licence, and that can be quite difficult to get it. There is one small union that was got an old union licence and was formed in the hope of being an independent union. It's called the Independent Workers Union, but in general, it's very hard to set up a new union.
My comment on what was talked about just then is, as an anarchist, I don't see why we would be looking towards a united front with unions. As we talked about, there's a leadership and a membership and the an attempt to make the membership more militant to push the leadership in some direction. Sometimes works in union, sure, but there's a bit of pressure that can go uphill. But the forces they've proven to be, like, there's been a pacifying, like, most of the pressure is going downhill from the leadership to the membership. And as you said, a lot of people in leadership positions don't have a reason to take the struggle to its legitimate, to where it should be going. And I think by continuously putting ourselves in the role of, like, trying to be this convince, like, the working class to join unions that do these organisations that have played a part in fucking them over, as well as winning, obviously, you know, winning a bunch of things, no doubt, through reforms. But I think we're looking like the old left. Like, I mean, we're looking like we aren't creating a different type of militancy energy that needs. It's just doing the same thing. I don't know why we'd be playing around with these unions still. Just because I know they exist as the biggest collective organisations, as you said, but surely we need to start from the ground level then, if that's what exists now. You know.
Okay. Well, I'll do is I'll take three people at a time, and then maybe have one of us respond to get as many people in as possible.
Okay, I've got a question for Chico, and then a couple of quick ones. Chico, as I understand, you were arguing you were giving the reason for the economic crisis as being the deregulation of the financial markets, the speculation and so on, and the massive transfer of wealth which we've seen in the last 10 years or so of globalisation. I'm not an expert on economics, but I have been convinced of a slightly different argument, that is actually a symptom of the underlying problem of crisis of overproduction and the falling rate of profit, and that capital has moved into financial markets and this fictitious capital to make these fake profits, but that even if capitalism, as it is attempted to do, was to introduce regulation again and tighten down those markets, it would not solve the underlying crisis of overproduction and the necessity for the destruction of that capital, and that the transfer of wealth is something that capitalism seeks to do, but it's not the reason for the crisis, which is deeper and more systematic. So I'm interested. I'll presume you're aware of that argument, and I'm just going to give you any comments on that. Just on the general perspective, I thought what you put forward was broadly what I would think too, the idea of kind of non-electoralist united front against the attacks, and I would agree that those need to be really clearly action-based and around clearly defined limited demands. But I think that you have to be careful not to limit things to that. That the political struggle between the alternative perspectives broadly outlined in revolutionary versus reformist will continue, and it's necessary for revolutionaries to side by side with this united front activity in and outside and the union structures, and not just within unions but across and inside, but also to be organising possibly what the anarchists would describe as affinity group or programmatically based caucuses at the same time to carry out that continuing political struggle, which will impact on those united fronts. The reformists will always want to limit those and undermine the struggle. One important political question being international connections, trying to make those real, particularly across Europe, because the crisis is European, but also an important political point, because you're correct that it's likely that that we are going to see an increase in nationalist ideology, and that it's important that revolutionaries consciously argue for an internationalist perspective against that and try to concretize that to the extent they can. Just one comment kind of picking up on what the previous person said about your final comment about trying to put pressure on the trade union leadership to force them to fight. I'm a bit wary of that as a generalised perspective. The role of the trade union bureaucracy is one social role of mediation between capital and labour, and the agents of capitalist ideology within the workers' movement. While we can get agreements against their will around particular issues, a perspective of getting them to make a generalised fight back is, I think, a very dangerous one, because they're not going to do that. It's not their social role. What we need to be doing is building these alternative organisations within what are broadly called rank and file, but I think you'd be careful about that rank and file. Some people pose that a bit wrongly, but still building organisations separate from and politically in opposition to the trade union leadership, the things which could really organise strikes, and so on.
I have a question about political strategy, and my question is, was sparked by Helene's comment about the people that she described as the solemn discontented. And my question is it wise from a political strategic point of view, if you want to put it in those terms, to sort of rule out in advance or to leave out of the equation appeal to those people, which are, after all, a large number of people in Ireland right now who are in this category of the solemn discontented? And I'm thinking more specifically that, again, from a political point of view, strategic point of view, that, that, you know, if you think about the old adage, the old libertarian socialist or anarchist adage, educate, organize, educate, agitate, organize. It's not just about agitation and organization. It's also about education. I think that's where, you know, the so-called sullen discontented, you know, come into the equation, that when people become more aware of the causes of, you know, their everyday economic difficulties, you know, in the current economic crisis, that then people have a potential to become angry, and a potential to become angry in a way which is politically constructive. So I wonder what you think about that.
Do you want to come back on that specific point?
Yeah, I could argue some of the other ones as well. all that said, I'm not saying we should leave them out, but I think we're small and we need to target, and if we don't target our arguments, then they're going to be lost. Like, I don't, if people are we could target the sullen discontented, educate them effectively, if we had the Irish Independent and the Irish Times and RTE in our control, because you're talking about the mass of society, but I don't think we have that. So when we're actually doing things, I think we have to make sure, well, who is it actually, who's that audience for our ideas, and how do we want to focus them, because otherwise a scattergun attempt is you're going to speak to, I mean, you're going to speak to people saying things that they already know, but they know things are bad, but they're not in a position to move. They will move when they see that it's something worth following. So what you have to do is try and build, you know, when it's like the prisoner's dilemma. You know, you'll get involved when you think that the cost of getting involved is worth it, because it's probably going to work. So you have to try and build the thing that's going to inspire people first, and then they'll follow. But that's a side thing. I wanted to, can I come back at some of the other stuff too?
Sure.
So I'm sorry, I didn't really think very clearly. I rambled a bit there, but on the unions, I mean, I agree with you, and I see where you're coming from. I see unions as, I think the role of a revolution is to say, what are the spaces that are available to us to operate on? What are the spaces that we can organise in, where we can get an audience for our ideas, where we can start building our skills and confidence as a class? So I see unions as a political space, and there are other political spaces that you would move in society. I don't think you just I mean I agree with you what you're saying about the leadership. I probably should have written down more precisely how to phrase that. But if I'm a nurse, and there's 40,000 nurses who are having a vote on whether to take part in the Croke Park Agreement, I think that's a space where, as a revolutionary, I should be engaged in. I should be saying, I'm in your union, I'm arguing against this because of this, and this is how we're going. I don't think that's the only thing I'm doing, and that's not the only organisation I'm in. And I think you're right, you do need to have, because of the unions, there is space, and there are space that are mean different things to different people, and you're right, they mean different things to the leadership, and they act in different ways. It's not just that you go into the unions and you throw all your political ideas behind you. You do need to have networks of militants between unions operating, and then you need to have people bringing political ideas within the union. So I think it's a space that you would be foolish to not engage in. But yes, you don't. It's not the only way, the only political activity you're involved in.
Okay, I'll try and answer briefly the question on the crisis, the idea of a crisis of overproduction. Okay, so essentially, the idea that capitalism has an inherent propensity to overproduce is an artifact of a specific line of Marxist economics, which is to do with the technical composition of capital, which says that the capital that is reinvested, or a certain proportion of all capital is reinvested, and therefore there's never enough money around to consume what's produced. Now, to me, you see, I mean, and it's actually sort of separate from the idea that there is a tendency within capitalism to towards a falling rate of profit. Now, to me, none of that stuff makes any sense, actually. I'm not a fan of Marxist economics at all. I think, actually, if you look inside it and look for evidence of it, the tendency to overproduce. Reinvested capital is still spent, it still goes into the economy, still pays, you know, money that's spent on investment is still spent, and therefore it doesn't disappear to me. So that doesn't make any sense at all. And secondly, like, if you actually look at the numbers in terms of the rates of profit, long term, there's no indication that there's a falling rate of profit. Like, the best indication of profits is stock markets, because stock markets, basically, a stock market price is expectation of future profits, and essentially, they go up and down, and they're sort of quite chaotic. But long term, over the 20th century, pretty much you can almost draw a straight line. And also, if you look in the immediate period immediately before this whole crisis broke, the whole thing that caused it to break wasn't the profits were falling, it was that there were such enormously large profits to be had by basically acquiring a whole bunch of subprime mortgages, hanging on to them for 3 months and reselling them. Like, the banks shouldn't have been doing it, but shouldn't have been holding on to the mortgages. It's not essential, it's not part of their business plan to own a whole load of mortgages. They're supposed to sell them on. They're supposed to not own buildings, okay? But the reason that they got into such trouble is because there's all these traders sitting there saying, if I hang on to this another month, I'll make another 20% on it. And so as that went through periods and periods, people just got more and more complacent and were leaving lots of subprime and also buying lots of property directly on the capital appreciation thing because they were making such great profits. So essentially, as I say, I think if you look inside a lot of the classical Marxist arguments and compare them to reality, they just don't stack up. And also, a lot of that stuff to me is sort of confusing and mystifying. If you look at it, something just simply distribution of wealth, something you can measure and something you can look at, and something that all makes sense to us, that if people run out of wealth, they can't consume anymore. It's just the word. It makes a lot more sense, and you don't have to get into, you know, the metaphysics of the three types of value or the technical compositions of capital or any of these type of things. And it's a world that you can explain and makes a lot more sense to people.
State politics. Would it not be better, I know I'm just trying to build up a protest movement, but would it not be better when, I would say in high summer, a mass rallies from the GPO and a static 3 o'clock to Parliament instead of being away one side and all of it. If people don't know this is going on, you know, down the country. If you know what I'm getting at. It seems to be very badly. I know that the establishment won't publicise it unless that you mention Duffy. And then, of course, you get bad publicity. The centre of the city, the GPO, that's the place to start street politics. And another point, why can't the left, on this occasion, all the left, yet I have a lifetime now in left-wing movements and Marxists, why not on this occasion can the left not get together? And trade unionism, a lifelong trade union, but never once, I was a trade union activist both in Britain and London and Dublin many years ago. I was never once on an official strike. It was always a wildcat strike. And I can tell you where some men, especially that came from this building, ended up. Chris McGrath from Dundalk ended up with Tom Reynolds of CIF, who was now Tom Parlin. He was the chief then. Where did he end up then after Tom Reynolds wasn't right enough for him? He ended up depriving Irish workers and Irish shipping of their jobs for Sir Anthony or whoever. There's another man here. I don't know whether he's still in the union here or not. I won't mention his name in case he is. He now is a director for Tom Parker. But having said all that, I would advise every young person to be a member of the trade union, as that lassie said there, to get involved in the branch committee. I'd shot sure 11-4, and then branch committee level. It is much better to be a member of the trade union than not to be a member. And they're like voting in governments, it's the membership it and may. Thank you.
Just a point around the F's response to the crisis. I think it's probably displayed or given evidence of how weak the organised left is, radical left is in this state. And I think the debate, like, there's a number of things that that's probably not time to get into in terms of, you know, the analysis of both main rights in terms of the media, the economy, the beta, the books and all of that. I mean, we're talking now, it's probably a year since the McCarthy report was published, which is essentially the government's charter as to how it's going to cut its way through the crisis. And on top of that, we've had an $80 billion bailout to banks, and the response from that effort has been quite disorganised and weak. A lot of that is to do with the history of the radical left in Ireland. A lot of it's to do with social partnership. A lot of it's to do with the fact that, you know, people are in hock to banks in terms of mortgages. And we've one of the highest levels of home ownership or mortgaged housing in Europe. I think it's 89%. I think people are genuinely fearful of actually going out and strike and all of that sort of stuff. But in terms of the actual response, I think there's a number of issues, I think, that need to be teased out with regards how we actually respond. And one of the things I'd like to see us looking at is that coming up to the next budget, which is due in December, which is proposing another $3 to $4 billion of cuts, is that we've built a sufficient momentum that it's politically impossible for government to force that budget through. I think that needs to be, I think for a lot of people now it is almost too big to get their heads around, but it's such a massive tranche of money, and it's also when people feel it's been done and what can you do about it. But I think if we're looking to create some small victories over the next period, I think one of the things we need to focus on is a campaign that effectively mobilises both the radical left and also all of the various community struggles, workplace struggles, that in some way can bring that together, and the political programme being, or the political slogan being, whether it's around taxing the wealth or that, you know, that budget isn't going to get through. Now, it's how we deal with that. And I think there's plenty of, I mean, if you look at, for example, I mean, the marches that have been organised in Dublin in the last 3 weeks have been very, very small relative to the size of the city. I mean, you're talking about 1,000 to 1,500 people have turned up. Most of them, I'd say 90% of them, are already within activist networks of some description. So we haven't mobilised a broader mass. We haven't mobilised people who are engaged in community struggles in the likes of Trees Gardens, Dolphin House, you know, people involved in challenging the public-private partnership processes and all of that. So I think that needs to be part of it. You go to the likes of Wexford or Lifford, where there's thousands of people coming out in marches against cuts in local health services. I think that's a reflection maybe of the fact that people can relate, obviously, more to what's happening in their own local community and are willing to come out on those issues. So I think the challenge is, how do you join up those various struggles that are happening, stuff that's happening in Mayo, and all of that, how, over the next period, like, how do we join up those struggles, bring those struggles together, and create that sort of level of momentum? Because it's very easy for the state to isolate, and I think one of the effective things around Rossport has been the fact that it has been a national campaign, that the state hasn't been able to isolate it to Mayo and break it on that basis, but it has broken out of Mayo to a national campaign. So how do we actually, as the radical left, which is quite small, bring those struggles together and build it to a momentum over the next period, right up to December? And you're also going to find, and it's already started, like the kite flying, if you like, from various government ministers around in the next, and it's just been confirmed this morning, is around essentially a workfare programme in terms of social welfare that people are going to be forced into low-paying jobs. You're also going to find the next battles from the likes of the independent group of newspapers and others in the media will be around the minimum wage. So all these things are coming. We know they're coming. And we need to be able to respond effectively. That isn't, in a sense, anchored. What our problem has been, it's been quite reactive. And we haven't sat back and actually planned a strategy that we can actually tackle this stuff. So I would like to see over the next short period that we're actually, you know, starting to develop that strategy that brings those groups together. And whether that's a national conference at some point over the summer that brings these various organised groups or campaigns together, and that we come up with a very, very simple slogan, or political, whether it's a political programme or a slogan, or something that people can actually sign up to and feel that what's happening in Donegal or Wexford or Rossport or Dolphin House or any of these places that they can, that it makes those links for people, that what's the crisis of capitalism is why people in Dolphin House are living in 19th century, effectively 19th century slums, and why cuts are happening in different hospitals, and why Shell are being basically able to do whatever they like in Mayo.
Yeah, just on street politics, but just went back a few weeks and I attended those two Tuesday things, and it was very much like Groundhog Day during the anti-war movement. It just seemed very either therapeutic or people positioning themselves as groups to promote themselves. I thought the anti-capitalist bloc was a nice little initiative, and what Eric Green is doing in terms of civil disobedience. But there is going to be resistance. Like, to the war, most of the resistance came out of the US military and the British military. Soldiers refusing to deploy, and the anti-war movement failed to offer solidarity to them. And in The Guardian this week, there was a Dublin woman being evicted from her house, and she put up resistance. She went on the roof or whatever for a number of hours. Just wondering how common evictions are going to be. That's the point of solidarity and resistance. And in terms of getting people along to manifestations, I would think, like, promoting it on the afternoon, where people just find themselves in the locality, downtown. They might stay another hour or so to get to attend something. And I'd also say, that soapbox speaking, what we did in Temple Bar for a couple of years, the incredibly dynamic interaction with ordinary people. And people have the ability to question the speaker. But these things at the door are just incredibly boring. I mean, most people just sitting there, hopefully the weather's good, and socialising, and a few people get to speak. Whereas in this more intimate kind of soapboxing, people can ask questions, they can argue, they can debate, and express their frustrations and angers. There's plenty of it around.
Just briefly to answer one of Stuart's questions, really, about how you actually build for some kind of alliance or whatever. I mean, I come from Newbridge in Kildare, where there's going to be 300 job losses in Port Wyatt or whatever it's called now. It's basically the biggest employer in the town, right? But like, for years I was in Social Party. Why did I join Social Party in Dublin? Because it wasn't organised in Kildare. And one thing that can is quite simple is public meetings in kind of rural inverted commas areas, like not in Dublin. Like, the Right to Work campaign is so Dublin centric that, I mean, you have to come, like, people have come up from Newbridge for it, but I mean, it's, they're not being engaged with in any way, because then they go back to Newbridge and no one goes like, well, do you want to set up something down there or whatever. So, like, a public meeting with a view to, like, obviously number one, educating people, but number two is to kind of get the activist core or whatever that can set up the campaign along with themselves, be autonomous, relatively autonomous, like, and do that, like, I'm using Newbridge as an example, but do that all over the country, and I think that's, it's quite a simple and effective way to get things moving. We'll probably have to wait until after, like, sorry to go on, but I've always felt, like, because I come from the country, that everything is Dublin-centric. Like, like, protests that you see on TV, generally you see them, they're in Dublin or whatever. And there could be, like, two or three left-wing guys in a village somewhere that are, don't even know each other or whatever, but they're disconnected from any kind of wider movement. And with a formation of some kind of alliance or united front, that becomes a focal point that you can actually then contact and go, well, hey, look, I'm interested in organising this in my area, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that, I think, these are simple but necessary things that not all thought about.
Okay, we're running over time, so if you, people can fairly brief, want to get in? Does anybody else want to get in before? Okay, take it to you. Keep brief.
I think there's a huge amount of discontent. I think we all know there's a huge amount of discontent. And the problem, if last year the trade unions were bringing out 120,000 people out onto the streets, the question has to be asked, why there isn't 20,000 people actually doing anything practically right now, 1 year later? And the fact is that this state has been infiltrated, not the state, but the people have been infiltrated by the state at every level. I mean, the trade union, every traditional forum for resistance in this country has been extremely successfully infiltrated by the state. The trade unions, the NGO to sponsorship and money. They're all terrified to campaign. I mean, I campaign for people who, you know, they will not campaign against the government on any issue. The community sector through these C schemes and funding, that he who pays the piper calls the tune. That's the way of life. And basically, the only way we're going to anti-none of this country is if somebody reverses that, and reverses it at each one of these levels. Okay? So I think what the left in Ireland needs to do is to set up some kind of community council or some type of organisation in every area, which is, you know, basically a place where people who have problems, and not for the left to say, to preach to the people, but for somebody to say, what problem do you have and what do you want to do to solve it in this area? I'm from Ballyferrin, okay? CIE are bringing in 200 bus cuts, 150 drivers have been taken off. During the week, Sinn Féin organised a meeting to talk about some kind of resistance to this, but it was organised by Sinn Féin. I'm not saying that Angus O'Sullivan has any agenda, anybody has any agendas in this, but the fact is, political parties work for political parties. That's what they were set up to do. Now, that bus campaign has been organised by a political party. The other campaigns like it are usually organised by political parties too, or infiltrated by them. So what you have is, there is actually no way of autonomous organisation in this country. You know, if you have a problem, who do you go to? You go to a political party, you go to a trade union, you go to your NGO, or you go to your community group. And none of them are, you know, in my estimation, very reliable. Now, the political groups are the most innocent, but nevertheless, they have an agenda. So what I'm suggesting is that wouldn't it be just a simple idea in each area to set up just basically sort of an autonomous council where people can come and bring their issues and divide up into areas like health or, you know, unemployment or, you know, whatever, because those issues will be different from area to area. Some of them are kind of national, you know, unemployment, health. And, you know, the anger is out there, the mobilisation is out there, but they're, as I think Wostrotsky said, the steam has to be put into the machine. You know, energy has to be put to work. Otherwise, it just gets, you know, you let out the relief valve and the steam just goes up into the hot air. You know, and this is the moment when that, you know, these times are the moment for those changes to take place. You know, this state is in collapse.
I'm getting pushed to the back, so I've got two more people want to come in.
You have to take the opportunity.
Okay, so keep briefly.
Just like it was mentioned earlier about the spaces where we have the organising. I mean, I'm from West Belfast, which, like, the majority of people don't have jobs, much less are in a union, you know. But, I mean, I think in every community in Ireland, there's something there that you can organise. Whether it's a residence group, whether it's, I mean, I'm in the GA, which is not, of course, a radical organisation in any sense, but our GA club has organised a monthly community lecture series, which is, like, education towards community self-empowerment. And I think up and down the country, there is something there. There's something in every single community, whether it be a residence group, GEA, if you can twist their arm and do something for you, or whatever it happens to be, that when they're, I can push these issues. I mean, our residency was working around people who are being affected, because it is starting, you know, it's only dribbles now, but there'll be more later when this recession gets worse. And I think that it's just somewhere that space there. These aren't revolutionary organizations in any sense, but like, we're talking about mobilizing here, we're talking about, you know, whether it's fighting the budget here in 26, whether it's just fighting these cuts that are coming in the 620s. I mean, you know, there's avenues there that I think would be pushing in. You know, because like, there's an opportunity, there's an audience there who you can win over, even if it is, if you're basically on the local, you know, if you start off there, you can tie it into these bigger issues. But I think that there's avenues there we can want to look at and say that this can be used for a progressive end, you know, not a revolutionary end, but certainly a progressive one.
Frida?
Just two very great points. One is, I suppose, kind of linking in with what Stuart here on the Kevo said as well about kind of building some sort of a network to kind of connect up all of these various different groups. And one thing we haven't really mentioned is the use of media. Obviously, the media is not on our side, you see, with the kind of reporting of the recent protests. So, I mean, the only way around that is to create your own media. And I'm not just talking about on the bigger overall issues, but on the individual case-by-case things. And that can actually be the start of creating a network. I mean, something as simple as indie media, or maybe creating something beyond that, where there are individual cases, whether it's police harassment of individuals in Dublin, whether it's a case of a house eviction somewhere down the country, or job losses somewhere else in the country, whatever it might be. We actually create our own media with a particular slant on it that's not just the biased standard down the line. And that actually allows people a platform or a front to actually air their issues without necessarily having to mobilise a lot of people in the town or out in the street. The other thing then is just about kind of mass mobilisation or street mobilisation. I think I'm obviously all for it, but the amount of people that I met on the second Right to Work march, which was supposed to be the big, you know, the big one, who weren't normally, they would have been part of the Southern Discontent, you know what I mean? People who don't normally come out to protest. And they were just saying, is this what I come out for? I didn't come out here to listen to basically the same people pushing the same line about nothing, and certainly not to watch people dressed up as Marie Antoinette from Bunza. You know what I mean? It just seemed, people were actually felt really demeaned by it. And I think if we start looking at street politics or mobilisation again, we need to do something that people see as more effective. Now, some people will be scared away by burning effigies or occupations or whatever it is, but at the same time, people see it as effective. So I think we need to find some way of kind of combining, getting away from just a platform that's people saying the same thing over and over again, bringing direct action in. But if we're looking at mobilisation, that's not necessarily about direct action. Make it very, very focused, and not just a platform for more and more of the left just to air their same ideological standpoint or whatever it is. But the media thing, and creating our own media, I think, is possibly the only way we can kind of beat the system we're fighting against, because that's what's, you know, pushing the virus around.
Okay, so just coming to close, I'm just going to say a couple of last things myself, and then we'll leave space for the next session. To go back right to the sort of question at the start about, you know, why be involved with the unions, why try and influence that? I think, I mean, that's sort of one of those long-running arguments that's been going within anarchism and outside anarchism for a while. But in the particular period we're in, where it's a question of needing to mobilise, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers, the unions actually do offer us the way to do that. And that's not a theory, because we've already had a one-day general strike that saw 250,000 workers come out. And it's also, I mean, because I'm in a union and work, and because we're organised, it means we have assemblies where, you know, 100-plus members turn up, and I can get up and I can make these sort of arguments at these assemblies. We've got other members who are on ununionised workplaces, and what they're saying is, like, there's nothing like that. You know, they can't get up in the canteen and say that sort of stuff, because they'd probably just get fired. They could do it on the level of individual conversations, but that doesn't move anybody fast anywhere. So I think particularly at the current moment, the need to actually engage where workers are at and not where we wish they would be is very important. The second part of that is our experience over the last couple of years, and Aileen talked about some of it, has been you can actually restructure the way things work at the level of sections and branches at unions relatively quickly. You can move things from having a, you know, a small group of people who meet and make all the decisions every couple of months and nobody's that aware of, to a situation where you have regular assemblies of all the members. And that has a huge impact on people's radicalisation. I mean, my experience of this was that at the start of this process, when we had one of these meetings, the trade union official would generally get up at the start and say, look, we're not trying to organise a strike here, people don't need to be scared. And you'd have this whole thing where the picture of most of the union members who turned up was that the union, as they saw it, the leadership, were to the left and far more radical than what they wanted to be. But by the time, in the period we're in now with the public sector agreement, the only person who was willing to actually make an argument out of 100 people for the public sector agreement was the same union official. So the actual experience of those assemblies had shifted every one of the people who regularly went to it a long way over that period of time. And I think that's essential. And the last thing is once again, to repeat the thing about the sheer scale of numbers. If we're going to defeat the government, we're not going to defeat the government because 1,000 of us or 2,000 of us or 5,000 of us do something. It's going to actually take hundreds of thousands. It's not even a question of tens of thousands. I think just on the left, unity, because that came up a couple of times as well. I think the way to look at this is not a question of the unity of the political parties of the far left. There are loads of barriers to that, you know, make it a very difficult process to happen. There's historic distrust, there's political differences, and in reality, all those organisations are tiny. I mean, together, you know, even if you put in the kind of the Republican left, you're talking about less than 1,000 people in the country. It has no real influence and not that much potential. The only sort of united front that makes sense is one that pulls in community organisations, campaigning organisations, and most importantly of all, union branches. And I think it's not so much a question of pressurising the union leadership, but rather of getting branches on board, because that is a possibility. If you actually had something that looked fairly real now, probably tomorrow, well, not tomorrow morning, but within the next 2 or 3 weeks, you could get 10, 15 branches signed up to it. And it's a question of working from where we are now towards that. And I think that's where the whole discussion about street protests, all that sort of stuff, networking, left activists, left organisations goes. Not that we prematurely declare ourselves to be this, but that we start collectively building towards it and get to the point where actually this sort of thing can be put together and it's real. And whether it's by the budget or whether at some later point that might be too early, who knows really, I think that's the important thing. So I think if there were two things I wanted people to take away from this. One is the importance of actually, if you're in a position to get involved in the union where you work, doing so, because you will find that over quite a short period of time, it's possible to move to something much more central. And the second thing is to start pushing this idea that what we need is a genuine united front. You know, that's not just about the left, it's also about community groups, it's also about union branches.
This audio was recorded at the 2010 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. The session was Fighting the Crisis, and it asked the question, after the anti-capitalist blocs and the Anglo-Irish protests, how can we build to defeat the government and make the rich pay for the crisis? You'll find more audio from the book fair at www.wsm.ie. The audio was recorded and edited by Andrew Flood.